We're going to play Bible baseball. We're going to go all over the Bible and make some connections. And I'm going to work you really hard. We've only got an hour, and it seems like we've got a couple of choices. We could have we could really get into discussion and spend the whole hour like on Sodom and Gomorrah, or we could try to deal with all of this and get some information out, make some connections, and then tomorrow, the last day of the series, is given over completely to discussion. So maybe we can go through that and go through all this, make kind of an agreement that questions of clarification are always welcome. Argumentative questions, we could leave till tomorrow. I mean, like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Does that seem like an agreeable thing?
Yeah.
Okay. Two things I'd like you to keep in mind as we go through this whole thing. First, remembering John Boswell's hypothesis that we talked about a couple days ago in terms of his huge award-winning Christianity, Homosexuality, and Social Tolerance, in which he posits that depending on whether the culture is urban or rural, dictates how gay people, women in general, and in Christian society, Jews, were treated at any given point in time, and that there's nothing intrinsic in Christian tradition and gospel tradition that bans homosexuality from the community. The other is that we keep in mind the connections that will be very clear as we move through this between homophobia and sexism, that the treatment of women in society and the treatment of gay men in society is very much linked, which is a basic premise of Carter Hayward's book, Touching Our Strength, which is waiting for you in the bookstore, Exciting Adventures. And also I'd like to lift up Is the Homosexual My Neighbor, which is about 10 years old now. It's also in the bookstore, and it's great for Homophobia 101. It's great for adult discussion groups in your congregation. It's great for sending to mom and dad if you're afraid to come out to them. It's very accessible and readable. It covers all the Bible stuff. It covers the scientific research. It covers ethical choices along the way that the community can make in terms of Christian communities' relationships with gay and lesbian people. So let's start. Probably I talk about this in terms of the seven deadly Bible verses. Probably the story that has least to do with homosexuality as we understand it, and yet is most powerful in the mind of popular culture, is Sodom and Gomorrah. But before we get to that, let's look up Judges 19, which is on page 227. Don't tell Esther that I'm giving you page numbers. Shameful. But I'm real conscious of getting through all this in time. Look up 227. This is an older story than Sodom and Gomorrah, and you'll see that it's basically the same story. And it's very painful to read. So Betty Davis says, fasten your seatbelt. Let's start with the 20th verse. The point here is that, is the sin of Sodom homosexuality, or is it inhospitality? The old man, who is the host here, says to the sojourning stranger, peace to you, I will care for you and all your wants, only do not spend the night in the town square. So he brought him into his house and gave his asses provender, and they washed their feet, and they ate, and they drank. And they were making their hearts merry, and behold, the men of the city, base fellows, beset the house round about, beating on the door. And they said to the old man, the master of the house, bring out the man who came into your house, that we may know him. And the man, the master of the house, went out to them and said, no, my brethren, do not act so wickedly, seeing that this man has come into my house. Do not do this vile thing. Behold, here are my virgin daughter and his concubine. Let me bring them out to you now. Ravish them, rape them, and do with them what seems good to you, but against this man do not do so vile a thing. But the men would not listen to him, so the man seized his concubine and put her out to them. And they knew her and abused her all night until morning. And as the dawn began to break, they let her go. And as the morning appeared, the woman came and fell down at the door of the man's house where her master was till it was light. And her master rose up in the morning, and when he opened the door of the house and went out to go on his way, behold, there was his concubine lying at the door of the house with her hands on the threshold. And he said to her, get up, let us be going. But there was no answer. Then he put her upon the ass, and the man rose up and went away. And the story goes on. What we're pointing out here, first of all, is there a sexual ethic for our time in this kind of historical social context? Notice the severe patriarchal value system here, in which women, it's okay, you know, to save a man's life, it's okay to throw the women out to the crowd. And the governing law here is the law of hospitality. And we might think, well, how can that be such a basic, important law? It's like we think of happy hour. But when we're living in a primitive tribal society in which there are, you know, no trains, no cars, no telephones, no hotels, hospitality becomes a basic survival law of community. It's the same in Greek culture. Next to hubris alone, which is the sin of pride in the face of the gods, the sin of inhospitality is the most severe sin in Greek mythology. So we have many stories, many folk tales in Greek mythology in which various gods and goddesses appear in human form and they walk along, and depending on how the people treat them, if they take them in or if they abuse them, they are blessed or cursed. And here we have a real similar story about reinforcing the law of hospitality. Now let's look at Genesis 19, which is the Sodom and Gomorrah story, which is on page 14, right? Way at the beginning. Now my personal location, I do not want to have a hidden agenda. What I'm doing here is trying to take a critical look at passages which historically have been used to oppress gay men and lesbians. And I imagine that most, if not all of us, are aware of other interpretations of these stories. So I'm just giving you an alternative idea that you can think about and talk about, and tomorrow we'll debate these a little more. Yesterday, knowing this day was coming up for me, yesterday when I was sitting in Joe's class and he was talking about Big Bang theory and how the universe started, and I just felt like, why isn't anybody screaming at him about that? The Bible says what I found in seminary, you know, in a really scholarly environment, is that professors and preachers in a seminary environment who would take very poetic approaches to the Genesis creation story, when they came to the Sodom and Gomorrah story, would never occur to them to think about why, how did this story come about, you know, aside from the moral lesson, what are we talking about? If you go to Israel and you go to the Dead Sea area, which is one of the most scary and bleak places on earth, where nothing can grow, and it reminds you somewhat, if you've been like to in southwestern Colorado, there's the Garden of the Gods, all these strange
formations of rock that have developed through erosion. And it was a sacred place to the native people, and they called it the Garden of the Gods. And if you go to the Dead Sea area, you see these incredible limestone pillars, and you can take tours for North American Christians, and you're going on boat rides, and they'll say, now there's Lot's wife. You remember at the end of the story, she turns into a pillar of salt. This had to really work on the imaginations of the people, and it had to be a very taboo place because it's the Dead Sea. You go into this area and you're going to die. So it's a taboo place to go or you'll die, and also how did it get to be like that? You know, what's the story there? And a story did emerge. Which we have in Genesis 19. Where should we start? Start with the 19th verse. Well, let's start right at 1. Two angels came to Sodom in the evening. Do we question this now? I leave that one up to you also. And Lot was sitting in the gate of Sodom. This is significant because we're talking about, remember the hospitality thing? The gate is a very important place in guarding the gate of the city because this is a safe place in a wilderness haven, and you guard the gate, you're careful about the strangers who come in and out of your city. And Lot was sitting at the gate of Sodom, and when Lot saw them, he rose to meet them and bowed himself with his face to the earth and said, my lords, stand aside, I pray you, to your servant's house and spend the night and wash your feet. He's living in Canaanite society, but he's following Jewish hospitality laws, and he's welcoming these strangers into his house. And finally, they accept. And we move just down a little further to verse 4. But before they lay down, the men of the city, the men of Sodom, both young and old, all the people to the last man surrounded the house. Now, if all the people are gay, and if all the men in the village are gay, the way that we understand sexual orientation, then there is no city because there are no children, right? So, you know, take a look at what's being described here. Every man to the last man came to this house, and they called to Lot, where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us that we may know them. Lot went out. Now, the Hebrew word here is yadak, and it has the dual meaning. It can mean sexual intercourse, but it also means knowing, like getting to know you. And it also means getting to know God. And this is a real important distinction in lots of other ways, too, because it's from the Greeks. The Greek word for knowing and knowledge is gnosis. That's where we start getting the split between the intellectual knowing. And the Hebrews don't have that split. So sexual knowing is the same as interpersonal knowing, is the same as spiritual knowing. It's an experiential approach to reality.
So they used one Greek word to describe all those different types of knowing?
One Hebrew word,
and then
yadak, which is here.
So we don't really know which they meant, or
no.
Is that something we have to infer?
Every time, like genealogy, all that is really important, and it says, you know, Abraham knew Sarah. Yeah, that's this word. So it does have sexual implication, but it doesn't need to have sexual implication.
Okay.
And when you're, you know, when we're instructed to know our God, it's the same word.
Okay.
Lot went out of the door, it's verse 6. Lot went out of the door to the men, shut the door after him, and said, I beg you, my brothers, do not act so wickedly. Behold, I have two daughters who have not known man. Let me bring them out to you and do with them as you please. Only do nothing to these men, for they have come under the shelter of my roof. So the hospitality law is when they're in your house, you're responsible for their protection. And he's willing to sacrifice his daughters to rape and death to follow this law of saving these two sojourning men's life. Again, this is a sexual ethic for our time. Only do nothing to these men, for they have come under the shelter of my roof. But they said, stand back. And they said, this fellow came to sojourn. They're talking about Lot, who's a foreigner himself. And he would play judge. Now we will deal worse with you than with them. Then they pressed hard against the man Lot and drew near to break down the door. But the men, the angels, put forth their hands and brought Lot into the house with them and shut the door. And they struck with blindness the men who were at the door of the house, small and great, so that they wearied themselves groping for the door. And then the angels lead Lot and his family out with the instruction that they are not to look back. And Lot's wife looks back and turns into a pillar of salt, and the cities are destroyed, and that's how the salt formations of the Dead Sea came to be. Okay? So that's our basic story. Now, let's look up Ezekiel 16:49, which tells us what the story of Sodom and Gomorrah is about. That's on page 725. There are several references to the sin of Sodom, and they all fit into this same pattern from the prophets. Those of you who've been working with Esther on Amos, and Ezekiel is another of these prophets. And let's see, Ezekiel 16:49-48. As I live, says the Lord God, your sister Sodom and her daughters have not done as you and your daughters have done. In other words, your people are being worse, the Israelites are being worse than the Sodomites. Behold, this was the guilt of your sister Sodom. She and her daughters had pride, a surplus of food and prosperous ease, but did not aid the poor and the needy. They were haughty and did abominable things before me. Therefore I removed them when I saw it. In other words, the sin of Sodom is inhospitality. They're rich and they're not taking care of the welfare of the poor. And one of the questions that come into my mind is that in our very rich Western culture, why has it been so important that we turn away? Who's ever heard that the sin of Sodom is inhospitality and not taking care of the welfare of the poor? Have we ever heard that? Why has our attention been focused away from our social responsibility as told by the prophets and onto gay and lesbian people? And Jesus says something about this too, Luke 10:10, which looks like it's page 902. Jesus is about to send out his followers to be in pairs, to spread the good word among the towns and villages, and he's giving them some advice about how they should deal with rejection if it happens. And he says, but whenever you enter into a town and they do not receive you, go into its streets and say, even the dust of your town that clings to our feet, we wipe off against you. Nevertheless, know this, that the kingdom of God has come near to you. And I tell you, it will be more tolerable on that day for Sodom than for that town. Again, the clear reference is to hospitality and how we treat the stranger in our midst. So how ironic, then, that this story has been used by the church to justify such inhospitality to the sojourning gay and lesbian people in the midst of the church. That's section number one. Any kind of clarifying questions?
Yeah, can I just say something?
Yeah.
You just said the church has used this. I challenge that statement because Any noted theologian who knows has always interpreted that as hospitality. People who use proof texts and abuse the Bible use it against gays and lesbians. That is the church. I can't say they are the church.
Okay.
Church, in its true form, really knows the truth, I would say, and they are the persons who interpret it rightly, and it is inhospitality. You know what I mean?
Yes.
But there are, there are segments of the church that abuse it.
Okay. Yeah. I stand corrected. Thanks for that. Yes.
I'm curious about the two stories of Sodom and Gomorrah, the story of Judges with the men gathering around the house and the house being protected. It seems so similar that historically there must be some significance there. But what is it that the hospitality is not looked at favorably by the people in the town? Why the attack, or why the attempted attack?
Both stories are emerging during the time that the Israelites are moving into Canaanite territory. The Judges story is about Abraham and his household, which would include all the servants and the clan. And Lot also is Abraham's nephew as they're moving into the Canaanite or Palestinian land, and the people around them doing this are the native peoples, right? So we're also getting some the stories are, among other things, making some distinctions between the good guys and the bad guys, I would say. Okay, the next section is from Leviticus. And the two the Levites are the priestly class. Leviticus is the book of the priests, or the priestly law. Deuteronomy is literally the book of the law. Leviticus 18:22 is on page 100. What these are is referred to as the Holiness Code. And the Holiness Code was codified as we know it today during the Babylonian captivity. Babylon conquers Israel and takes off almost the entire aristocracy, ruling class, and middle class, leaving not very many people left, drag them into slavery in Babylon in the year 587, which is a really important year because this marks, the captivity marks where scholars divide Hebrew and Jew. Okay? The Holiness Code is the beginning of development of Judaism as we're more in touch with today. Not that Judaism has remained the same since 587, but before that we have a more Yahwistic tribal religion. Afterwards we get this Judaizing code, which is meant primarily to ensure that they remain a unique people, even while they're in captivity in a foreign land, in a foreign culture. Certainly, a lot of the laws in Leviticus and Deuteronomy were tribal custom before that and are now being codified. But others are specifically created now in the context of Babylonian culture as a reaction against it, to make sure that the Hebrew people remain a distinct entity. So Leviticus 18:22 is the famous one. Thou shalt not lie with a man as with a woman. It is an abomination to the Lord. Now, just looking at that law literally, what's the sin?
Lying.
What makes it a sin for a man to lie with a man? It's like a woman. It's treating another man like a woman. Right? And the tradition, the patriarchal tradition is, men are created in God's image. And then the rib story, women are created in men's image. And then children are created, then we have this whole, what's that called, the chain of, there's this whole hierarchy of, you know, and then come the animals and then come the plants. So they're understanding this, first of all, as it's defiling the image of God, because it's treating another man like a woman. Secondly, it's defiling the nature of men, because women are closer to cattle than they are to other men in terms of their social value. I mean, they're traded, they're bought and sold. They're not allowed to be educated. They're not allowed to, even in Jesus' time, they're not allowed to testify in court, because women, like children, have simple minds. So the sin, and notice, once again, it's this connection between sexism and heterosexism. They're dependent on each other. Men have to be controlled to have control over women, or the system is going to fall apart. Another part of this, and women are terribly restricted because we're talking about patriarchal bloodlines. Men have to know who the father is of the woman's offspring. So women need to be controlled real carefully so that they don't have sex with other people. So that the inheritance can go from the father to the son.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is this one of the reasons why there's no prescription anywhere that in the Levitical codes against lesbian, like against women, women?
Yes, lesbian activity later in the Mishra, as the tradition develops around this, is defined as obscene, but not It disqualified a woman from marrying a priest, but not from marrying anyone else. So as obscene, it has the same level of distaste as menstruation. But it didn't defy virginity, which is the governing force. Now there are 632 of these kinds of laws, which in general Christian tradition says we don't have to follow any of them. Let's look at another one. Leviticus 15:25 on page 98. Starting on the previous page at the bottom, on verse 19, this is a whole long two-paragraph section on menstruation in women. When a woman has a discharge of blood, which is a regular discharge from her body, she shall be in her impurity for 7 days, and whoever touches her shall be unclean until the evening. A whole law was around this notion of uncleanness and purity rituals. Skipping down to 25, if a woman has a discharge of blood for many days, not at the time of her impurity, or if she has a discharge beyond the time of her impurity, all the days of the discharge shall continue in uncleanness. Verse 26, every bed on which she lies, all the days of her discharge shall be to her as the bed of her impurity, and everything on which she sits shall be unclean. And whoever touches these things, like if her husband or another man touches the bed or the chair, they shall be unclean, and wash his clothes and bathe himself in water and be unclean until the evening. But if she is cleansed of her discharge, she shall count for herself 7 days, and after that she shall be clean. And on the eighth day she shall take 2 turtle doves or 2 young pigeons and bring them to the priest to the door of the tent of meeting, and the priest shall offer one as a sin offering and the other as a burnt offering, and the priest shall make atonement for her before the Lord for her unclean discharge. There's a lot of blood taboo, both in kosher laws are about how to deal with the blood of animals, whether or not they can be eaten. No, we don't require women to do this anymore. But this one, this, a lot of Christians feel, still needs to be enforced. It raises for me then the question of, is the Bible in these situations being used to read what Christ did in this situation? Mark 5:25. Page 871. And if you haven't guessed, it's the story, as it says in the King James Bible, the woman with an issue. Which is always a fun title to use for a feminist sermon. verse 25. And there was a woman who had a flow of blood for 12 years. I mean, this woman is single-handedly depleting the pigeon population. And beyond that, 12 is a really significant number. It's the 12 seasons, the 12 months of the year, the 12 tribes of Israel, the 12 disciples. 12 is the only number that's mystical enough to have its own name, the dozen. Besides the literal truth that she's been menstruating for 12 years, the symbolic truth is that this is total uncleanness. You know, what could be more unclean than a woman bleeding for 12 years? And Jesus heals her, and it's through touch. And Jesus says, your faith has made you well. Now, we're living in a society of the veil, like Iran today. Women were covered up. They could not be in public until the father had sold her to the husband. Wives had to walk paces behind their husbands, and particularly rabbis, of which Jesus was one, could not talk to women in public. So we've got, or they would be unclean. So we've got all these ritual Levitical taboos being broken, besides which she's menstruating for 12 years, and through touch is healed. And Jesus talks to her and says, your faith has made you well. Not fulfilling the law, but her faith. Her relationship of faith with Christ had healed this total unclean state as defined by the law. And this is a story reflected in all of the Gospels. And it's only one example of the continuous ministry of Jesus in breaking the law and applying grace to situations of all sorts of people who are outcast by the law. The rest of the passages are from the Pauline corpus. And I think it's important to keep in mind, once again, John Boswell's premise about small towns and big cities, and Paul is going to the big city. And what does he see there? So, 1 Corinthians 6:9, that's on page 994. Another favorite. Do you not know that the unrighteous will not inherit the kingdom of God? Do not be deceived. Neither the immoral, nor idolaters, nor adulterers, nor sexual perverts, that's the key word, nor thieves, nor the greedy, nor drunkards, nor revilers, nor robbers will inherit the kingdom of God. The original word here is the Greek word malaki. In this list of thieves and idolaters and so on. And Malachi in Greek means soft. My t-shirt is soft. And just like in modern English, our language is very flexible and pliable. It would assume within this list that perhaps, more than perhaps, Paul is talking about moral weakness. It would be like 2,000 years from now, if someone is reading a list like this and comes across the word spineless. And, what does it mean to be spineless? How could this person be alive? Well, we use that term to mean, without backbone, without moral fortitude. Paul says people who are soft are not going to inherit the kingdom. When the King James Version is translated in this into English, it translates that as effeminate. So the King James Version says that effeminate people are not going to enter the kingdom. King James incidentally was a gay man who had a great emotional investment in the arts, and so he created a commission to produce this beautifully languaged Bible. And it's the time of Shakespeare. You know how when you're in high school you read Shakespeare, you can't understand because the words have changed so much in their meanings. The most usual use of effeminate at that time is self-indulgent. And how that came to our meaning of effeminate would be an interesting study in sexism itself, how our language changes. Then when the RSV translated effeminate in 1952, it said homosexual. Then the scholarly community objected to that so much that this is the second edition that came out in 1971, I think. And changed homosexual to what? Sexual pervert. And in the last 20 years, we have the New International Version, we have the New English Bible, we have Phillips, we even have the Reader's Digest. I haven't checked yet what they're but it's interesting to look up these words and see what kind of biases the translations show.
Dan, in what year was it created the RSV on homosexuality?
52. The other thing I think is interesting about that particular verse is that for most of church history, church tradition has used that to refer to masturbation as a prescription against masturbation. But the point is, it's a term that has some sexual overtones, but nobody's really quite clear what it is. So most of church history, there's no reference at all to homosexuality.
Yes, in fact, the King James has two divided. I guess they must not have been able to figure it out. So where we have one word in the King James, it's two words. It's effeminate and abusers of themselves. And that reminds me of there's. The sin of onanism. We don't have a clear understanding of human sexuality at all, like we do here today. I mean, in our own time and place. So that the sin of onanism, which is masturbation, if you're old enough to remember when that was, people were still being oppressed about that. Where that comes from is that women were understood to be, to not be active participants in reproduction, just the garden in which the seed was planted, and that the semen was then, you know, minuscule, complete human beings, so that to masturbate was to commit murder, because you were murdering one of these little human beings that was being planted into the woman's garden to grow. And that's a view that's how sexuality was understood all the way through biblical history, way into church tradition.
You may want to know that the new RSV says male prostitute.
Which is particularly true on the Timothy passage, which we can look at right now, which is on page 1034. Timothy is Paul's young sidekick in ministry. They travel together, and then Timothy goes, it's sort of an apprentice relationship. Timothy goes off to do his own ministry, and Paul writes him probably more than the couple of letters that we have. Another list. Now we know, starting at 8, now we know that the law is good if anyone uses it lawfully, understanding this, that the law is not laid down for the just, but for the lawless and disobedient, for the ungodly and sinners, for the unholy and profane, for murderers of fathers and murderers of mothers, for manslayers, immoral persons, sodomites, kidnappers, liars, perjurers, and whatever else is contrary to sound doctrine, in accordance with the glorious gospel of the blessed God with which I have been entrusted. Scholars question whether this is actually a letter from Paul, because it's talking about doctrine, which seems, among other things in the letter, like vocabulary choices. But talking about doctrine at this early a point in church history, like the first generation, seems unlikely. The word is arsenokite, which is male prostitute in Greek, particularly with temple prostitution overtures.
How do you spell that?
A-R-S-E-N-O-K-E-T-A. Arsenokite. Esther talked about, as she's been talking about Hosea, talked about the Yahwehists moving into Canaan and coming up against Baal worship, and which was very much related to the religion of Babylon also. In Babylon, there was the god Marduk, the goddess Ashtart of the earth, and Ashtart appears throughout the Middle Eastern crescent in her name changes to Ishtar, for example. But this concept that the male god, the spirit god, has sex with the earth goddess and every spring, and that's what makes the flowers grow. And so the religious ritual was temple prostitution was a really important part of that religious life, because the society then views itself sort of like putting on pornographic movies, acting out pornographic movies to try to stimulate Marduk and Ashtar to have sex so that spring will come once again. So there were sexual rituals that were part of temple life, and we don't know a lot about the details, but from all indications, male prostitution, temple prostitution was a part of that. Why that would be involved in reproduction or in spring fertility rites, I don't know, but maybe it's more of their not understanding how that works. But anyway,
Yahweh, the nameless God, the God who is neither male nor female, is a long, is a long way from this, and we have this constant cultural struggle in the promised land between these two cultures. Paul is a Pharisee by training, that he goes through the conversion he does, of justification by grace, is an amazing thing, that he has a few hangovers about women and gay people is kind of understandable to me, considering the conversion that he goes through, because he's living in a captivity very similar to the Babylonian captivity, and the Pharisees, as we talked about on the first day, were really nice people, and they had an agenda for saving Israel, which was fulfilling the law and keeping their culture intact, even though it was Roman occupied. So there's kind of a rebirth of holiness, and that's the tradition that Paul is coming out of. He's a doctor of the law. So that combined with the whole historic Yahwistic conflict with fertility religion, Arsenokite, when he goes to Athens and sees that happening, that must have made him angry. Mm-hmm. Yes.
What's interesting, I just thought about something right now, and the genealogy of our Lord Jesus, one of his ancestors, was Rahab.
Yes. And that's a real fun study in itself.
And then, itself. You see, and when they're trying to keep this line absolutely pure, here's Rahab.
Yes, and Matthew's doing an interesting thing in that first chapter of the genealogy of Jesus. There's four women in a society in which women were never mentioned in genealogies. There's Rahab, who's not only a Canaanite but a prostitute. There's Ruth, who's a Moabitess, and the Leviticus law strictly states that no Hebrew Jew forever is supposed to allow a Moabite into their community because they were bad to the Hebrews while they were wandering in the wilderness. So Ruth breaks the law too. And then there's Bathsheba, and she's mentioned not by name but as Uzziah's wife, to remind the readers that another one of Jesus' great-grandmothers is an adulteress. So besides listing out the genealogy for historical sake, Matthew's making some pretty radical statements, if you knew all these stories, about the role of grace as well as the role of women in the Christship of Jesus and the Christship of our community. It's not by fulfilling the law, but by believing in the promise. What saves all these women is not their lifestyle, it's believing in the promise that brings them into the community of covenant. The last one is Romans 1:26. Finally, we get to talk about lesbians.
What's the number?
977. For this reason, God gave them, like big city folks, up to dishonorable who are into idolatry, gave them up to dishonorable passions. Their women exchanged natural relations for unnatural, and the men likewise gave up natural relations with women and were consumed with passion for one another, men committing shameless acts with men and receiving in their own persons the due penalty for their error. some, we've got, Paul is making some sociological connections that we would not make today. Look up at verse 22. Who are these people there? And what's making them turn into homosexuals? Claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man or birds or animals or reptiles. So Paul, when he gets to the big city and sees all this activity that isn't, that all these relationships that aren't, that he's not used to, he also sees a whole lot of idolatry in the kind of classical sense of statue worship and stuff. He's making some connections here about, evidently, idol worship leads to these homosexual acts. And evidently, homosexual acts lead to something, some sort of illness that he's referring to, but we don't know what it is. He focuses, what connects those two for him, according to the text, is this idea of lust and passion. And it doesn't have, again, anything to do with sexual orientation as we understand it today. It doesn't have anything to do with loving, committed relationships between people who are by nature gay or lesbian. The use of natural in this context is real problematic because, in another place, Paul says women who cut their hair or men who let their hair grow are unnatural. And I remember my grandmother telling stories about when she was a teenager and bobbed her hair, being called up before the church and condemned for being unnatural and going against biblical truth. At a seminary, a professor liked to say that natural law is like guinea pigs. They're not pigs, and they don't live in Guinea. Again, there's an ironic thing in the use of Romans. This verse in Romans, as it's often used against gay and lesbian people, because what's this whole book about? What's the whole letter of Romans about? Justification by faith, by grace through faith alone. Let's look at verse 3:21. He's just listing all these sinful things because he's going to say everybody's sinful, everybody's separated from whole integrated being, and how do we get back into that state? But now the righteousness of God has been manifested apart from law, although the law and the prophets bear witness to it. The righteousness of God through faith in Jesus Christ for all who believe. There is no distinction, since all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. They are justified by God's grace as a gift through the redemption which is in Christ Jesus, whom God put forward as an expiation by his blood to be received by faith. This was to show God's righteousness, because in God's divine forbearance, God had passed over former sins and was to prove at the present time that he himself is righteous and that he justifies us who have faith in Jesus. And this is very late in Paul's career, and he's making connections between people with Jewish backgrounds and people with Gentile backgrounds, and how it's not a question of law, it's a question of faith. And this is, of course, what Luther was reading, what he got his inspiration. Let's look at Matthew 8, 5:13.
Speaking of
Mary. Yep, Matthew 8, 5:13. Which is on page 841. look at a Jesus story about a Roman. So we know from extra-biblical records that it was pretty common for older men in Greco-Roman society, for older men and to have younger companions who were sexual counterparts. And this is the story about a centurion, a man of wealth and power, who has a young servant who is ill. This story is also found in most of the Gospels. In Mark, the relationship is described as a servant who is very dear to him, to the centurion. As Jesus entered Capernaum, a centurion came forward to him, beseeching him and saying, "Rabbi, my servant is lying paralyzed at home in terrible distress." And Jesus said to him, "I will come and heal him." But the centurion answered him, "Rabbi, I am not worthy to have you under my roof, but only say the word and my servant will be healed. For I am a man under authority with soldiers under me, and I say to one, 'Go,' and he goes, and to another, 'Come,' and he comes, and to my slave, 'Do this,' and he does it." When Jesus heard him, he marveled and said to those who follow him, "Truly I say to you, not even in Israel have I found such faith. I tell you, many will come from east and west and sit at the table with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven, while the sons of the kingdom will be thrown into the outer darkness. Their men will weep and gnash their teeth." And to the centurion Jesus said, "Go, be it done for you as you have believed." And the servant was healed at that very moment. Now, there's no way to prove what the relationship between the centurion and the servant who was dear to him was, but it would certainly fit a pattern. And beyond that, we have just the fact that he's a Roman and not a Jew, and he's outside the law, but he's healed and brought into the kingdom through faith. Not law.